Okay, so shall we start?
Yes.
Okay, so this performance is called Fungi Synecdoche, A Hidden World. And away we go. It should be somewhere between maybe 35 and 45 minutes. And definitely different from the last presentation, for sure. It'll be mostly just pretty mushrooms. Okay, so the next time you...
Stop!
The next time you reach for that mushroom, stop and look more closely, because there's often a lot of things going on there that you might not have seen. Maybe you scared away the other creatures, maybe there's other things associated with the mushroom. And this is something that I think, I never met John Cage, but I think he would have probably encouraged everyone to do, and for sure Gary Lindhoff encouraged us to do. So if you approach the mushroom, even an edible, maybe just sit and wait a minute or two. I like to take cheese sandwiches with me. Just quit. Stuff will come back to the mushroom, and you might be really surprised to see all the things that are associated just with that single fruit body. There's a whole hidden world there. So this performance will be about seeing things for the first time, or seeing things in a new light, and also seeing that everything in nature is all interconnected. Okay, so today in the foray, we saw some fungi growing with other fungi and a lot of parasites and stuff like that. That's probably what you assume I'm going to talk about. Maybe mushrooms molding and things like that. And that's really not what this scene is here. This is this was a blushing Amanita, which we have on the table over there, and has this... As this Syzygianthes species of weed, we ran into something like this in the forest today. David mentioned something like this. It's not particularly interesting, although the name's kind of interesting. The name has to do with the syzygy, and that's when the spores line up when two different mating types come together on a petri plate. Then they go through sexual reproduction. That's how it gets its name, because the syzygy is sort of a lining of planets. So stuff like this is maybe what the talk will be about. But stuff that has more intention there of purposely parasitizing and even deforming things. So this is getting a little closer to maybe something that you might actually pick up. That last mushroom, you probably, had you seen it in the woods, you probably would have just said, it's a rotting mushroom, even though it wasn't really a rotting mushroom. It was something that was having a case of parasitism. This is the Hypomyces hyalinus. This is something that parasitizes Amanitas. And Hypomyces species, this is what they do. They don't make a fruit body to get them up into the air column to deliver their spores. They just take over other fruit bodies. This is a really common one, because this is also on, no doubt, one of the blushing Amanitas. But the fungus lives underground with the colony of the Amanita mycelium, and so it's never going to turn into a mushroom with gills or anything and make spores. But that's never going to happen. It's already going to be enslaved by this Hypomyces. So what's the big deal with that? Well, there's also Hypomyces, different species that attack boletes, and you've probably seen these moldy boletes, especially when it's kind of getting hot and dry in late summer. They seem to be very prevalent. And again, it's not something that sat around and got wet and rotted. It was something that was already associated with this parasite underground, and it came up. It was never going to be a bolete. It was just going to be a launching pad. Again, nothing that you probably would have picked or even really considered, because they look kind of gross. You certainly wouldn't want to eat if they're kind of soft and mushy. But sometimes some species of Hypomyces, like this is a different one, this is a third species now, it lives with different types of Russulas and Lactarius, which range from being not edible to being extremely gross. And I think I surreptitiously tricked some people into tasting some Lactarius today that were extremely apricot. You couldn't eat that as a food. However, those could be parasitized by this Hypomyces and then turn into an absolute choice edible, the lobster mushroom. And we had a couple on the table that I found today. This, I forget where this was picked, but maybe on the Pacific Northwest, because they have some species that are really big out there, and the lobsters get really big. So, really nice edible. There are green lobster mushrooms, quite a bit more rare, but they turn Russulus and Lactarius, when they're parasitized by Ludovirus, they turn into a green lobster, which absolutely are edible and pretty tasty. Even though they look kind of freaky, they're absolutely tasty. And believe it or not, there's even polypore lobsterization. This is whatever, fifth or sixth or seventh different species that I've shown, Hypomyces aurantia. So again, you wouldn't really notice this thing because it just looks like a polypore. But if you stop and consider a moment, why is it lobster orange underneath? Oh, it's something that was going to be a polypore, but now it's been taken over. And since you're going to ask me, can you just, it's still hard as a rock, like the woody comp that it was taking over. So in any case, that's sort of what's going to be happening with this presentation today. We'll be looking at things in new light. So pictured here, these little pictures around the perimeter of this image are things that are so unbelievably common to you, you probably wouldn't pick them up, except for maybe the boleweed. Up in the upper left are lichens. We saw lichens today, and I tucked some twigs into people's baskets, so they probably came out. I don't know if they made it onto the table. And if you don't know, lichen is this interesting symbiotic arrangement between a fungus and a photobiont, which would be a cyanobacterium or an algae or both. So it could be at least, it could be three things. And that's what lichens were, and they live in places that are too inhospitable for stuff to normally live. So on tombstones, tree branches up in the air, the sides of buildings, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody's known about lichens forever. No one's really been able to culture them and pull apart the photosynthetic partner and the fungal partner and grow them. So some people have thought, well, maybe we don't know all there is to know. Just a couple of years ago, an amateur mycologist did just that and found hidden right in front of us is something inside the lichen we've never seen before, and it's actually the most important partner. It's another different type of a fungus that you can't even see because it's such a small part of the whole lichen, but it's the puppet master for the whole thing. And this is astounding. All textbooks now have to be rewritten about what a lichen is because we thought we knew it and we didn't know. Things like endophytes, and if this is, maybe, yeah, you still. So things like endophytes are fungi that grow, and epiphytes too, are fungi that grow in and on plants. And everybody maybe has heard of them, and what's the big deal? Well, it turns out more and more often they're being found and turning up in places where people hadn't considered. Literally all species of plants are covered with epiphytic fungi, often so small you can't see them, but they're on the surface of plants and play an important role in sometimes nitrogen fixation of the plant, or warding off other pathogens, other fungi, etc. And also inside the plant, this is fescue grass, which is everywhere in North America and Europe. And inside is the puppet master of fescue grass. This is a fungus, and you can see it growing between the plant cells. And it was astounding when this was discovered, because then people start looking everywhere. These epiphytes are everywhere. There are fungal epiphytes here in this room on the table, and all Walker Heston didn't even know. Hidden in plain sight are wax caps, which of course all books will point out are sap robes. They rot grass and things like that in the environment. That's why they're on grassy lawns and stuff, but they're not. That's not what they do. It was just discovered a couple years ago. They're actually an endophytic symbiont of grasses. And how someone found this out was they super carefully looked at grass roots and followed, you know, this hair-like mycelium from this fungus into the grass root and found it was all the way up inside the plant and throughout all of the leaves and stems. So what they're doing in there, who knows? But a lot of other endophytes in plants produce plant growth regulators, hormones, regulate drought tolerance, and produce various types of toxins that ward off herbivores, like insect herbivores, mammal herbivores, etc. So the end of the story hasn't been written yet on what the different wax caps do, because it's just now been realized that they seem to be a fit. And then the bottom picture is just to sort of prompt me to mention mycorrhizae. These are different fungi in the environment that are partners with various plants. In fact, pretty much all plants, certainly all trees, have mycorrhizae fungi that grow on the roots of them. And they're the sort of the puppet masters of the whole plant. So I'll mention those in just a second. But let's start off the show with some lichens. I mentioned this business of this fourth part. part of the lichen story. This the city of mycete fungus, and that's all I'm going to do. You can Google that. Here's some other more, even more bizarre things about lichens when you see them. If you approach some of these lichens, this is a neat mixture of a white lichen and an orange lichen. Actually, the white lichen here is not occurring with the orange one. It's a parasite on the other lichen. So despite the fact that a lichen is a fungus with photobionts that photosynthesize when they get wet, and the fungal partner kind of protects them from the UV rays and drying out, and also can degrade the rocky or woody surface that they're on and eke out some nutrients, some of them don't even really rely so much on photosynthesis. They're actually parasites on other lichens, believe it or not. And here's another example over here. This pink lichen is a parasitic lichen on this other Peltidra lichen, which is everywhere. Even out in really moist woods, you'll see Peltidra. And if you look real close, you'll see other things growing on it. This is just one thing. There's all sorts of other things that grow on top of the lichens and can maybe parasitize them or whatever. As this last note points out, there's thousands of lichens that are lichenicolous fungi. So, or thousands of other fungi that are lichenicolous. So that means they grow on top of lichens. What they're doing, who knows? They're there. There's coffee table books that have beautiful pictures of lichens, and we had a special issue all about lichens just because they're insanely pretty, and they're always in the same spot, of course. They don't go away like a mushroom. They're always on that surface, even for centuries. So you'd think they'd be well studied, and everyone would know everything about them. They're always right in that spot, but we know almost nothing about them. You know, they have bizarre chemistries and everything that we probably scratched the surface. Okay, so about mycorrhizal fungi. So, of course, you learn in school and from some informational books and things like that on the fifth kingdom, the fungi, and isn't it wonderful that the fungi degrade stuff in the forest and rot stuff because all the stuff would be piling up and we would be buried under plant material, our own waste and everything. And that's actually pretty ridiculous because something would be good. But it's also ridiculous because the vast majority of all fungi do not rot things. The vast majority of fungi are either parasites or beneficial parasites, the mycorrhizae. So what are mycorrhizae? Things like bole leaves, the ammonitas, lots and lots of stuff on the table over there, all the tricholomas. All of those mushrooms you were picking from the soil, some of them may be rot stuff, but most of those big species over there, they aren't growing from the soil, they're actually growing from the roots of trees. In fact, they're farming the tree just like the lichen fungus is farming the algae and the cyanobacteria just in sort of a different place on the plant. But with the boletes, everyone knows, all books say all boletes are mycorrhizal, they all grow with plants. This, of course, is not true. There's a few species that were just recently discovered that can be cultivated in Asia. I've seen them growing in pots, and they're commercially grown now. So they definitely don't need a plant root. But what's also been shown is that more and more of boletes and even some other mycorrhizal fungi also have semi-subprobate nature. For the experts in the room, no doubt you know this bole. This is the admirable bole. It's a very pretty bole. When you see it, it's usually coming out of rotting stumps of trees and logs. And the reason it seems is that this thing can break down wood somewhat. So that probably benefits the fungus. Probably also benefits the tree roots that it's attached to because it can pass on some nutrition. And the more and more scientists look into the genomes of these mycorrhizal fungi, they find that they do still have genes for breaking down cellulose. Maybe not all the genes to completely break it down, but to be able to break down some of it. And here's how the mycorrhizals work if you're kind of new to the whole mushrooming thing. So another thing you learn in school, no doubt, is about how plants work. Pretty simple. They photosynthesize, the roots go down the soil, take up nutrients and water, etc., etc. That's not really true either. The roots really are pretty much just a stem that holds the plant down so it doesn't fall over. If you dig a tree up, you can demonstrate this to yourself. The roots look really naked and bare. They're just like kind of these stems. Even on the tips, the growing tips, not much going on there. What plants, especially trees, rely on is to be attacked and parasitized by their fungal partners that are symbiotic. So it's a beneficial parasitism, and the fungus then works sort of as the root system goes out in the soil, dramatically increases the surface area, and actually takes up water and nutrients. And it's even more than just sort of haphazard like I made it seem. these organisms have co-evolved for millions of years. So in the cell walls of these plants are actual gates and channels that have no other function but to pump nutrients and sugars, photosynthetic, into the fungal hyphae cells that are right up against them. And likewise, the fungal hyphae have gates and channels that have no other function but to pump nutrients into the plant. So they have, one has to have the other. And I mention this because if you're new to mushrooms and you want to go out and find morels and chanterelles and hingoleets and stuff like that, you can walk in the woods and stumble around the right time of year and maybe find them. But if you join the New York Mycological Society, the Mid-Hudson Club, or go with people that know what they're doing, they go purposefully around certain trees because they expect certain mushrooms to grow only with those trees and not with other trees. That European panther ammonite, I purposely was looking under Norway spruce to find that guy. And this morning I was purposely looking for that hingolete under the Norway spruce because that's the only thing it will grow in. So, you know, this will, learning some things about trees and the growth patterns of mushrooms will help you with your success by growing mushrooms. So next time you see this guy here, know that there's more going on than this thing just merely being mycorrhizal, which is pretty complex and pretty amazing, really. And this sort of an association has evolved numerous times. You know, the plant world is dominated by mycorrhizal fungi. Some that make mushrooms, the vast majority, we don't even know what they do there. A totally different style. So anyways, there's a lot of stuff going on when you see this simple bully. So I'm not going to flip back to it, but that quote, all bullies are mycorrhizal. So that would apply in older books to this too. This is the ash bullies. Bullies merluloides, which is probably going to go extinct because all the ash trees are going to be extinct because of a beetle.
Has already jumped to other ash trees.
That's good to know. Okay, and so it jumped to the other ash trees because how?
How did
you
do it?
Yeah.
There used to be ash trees in that area, and now it's going with the. It wasn't the main group, I think it was
the main group. That's interesting. So if they can do this, here's what has to happen. It's more simple than just jumping to the roots of a non-ash tree. So everyone assumed that this was mycorrhizal with ash trees, which is a weird association because ash trees really are not endomycorrhizal with any of the mushrooms. They're endomycorrhizal. That's a whole other can of worms of all of that means. Really no other mushrooms associate with ash trees. So someone got the bright idea to dig around these things because they said, well, they're not really even true bullies. They look like bullies, and they have these sort of veiny gill things. Here's another pretty shot. They have these sort of merluloid. They're really cool looking. Someone digging around where these things meet up with the roots, they're not actually attached to the roots. They're not mycorrhizal. They're a symbiont with an insect that's a parasite on the roots of ash trees. And they grow around the insect. The insect is attached, sucking the juices out of ash trees. They somehow find this insect on the roots of the ash trees, or they're waiting there for this to happen, and then they form a black gall around the insect and protect it. And that's the benefits that they both get this. So this is one of these are the little galls. They look like little seeds. If you dig these things up carefully, you find them. So if you so what's happening here is this thing's attached to the tree, getting nutrition. This is all that's going to happen. This thing's never going to be able to move from this. It's going to be its life from now on. And then the goodies coming from the tree passes through the insect and into the fungus.
Oh, and that's so the insects could help sense the vector.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I didn't know that they could jump to other trees, but then obviously it has to jump to a different aphid or its partner has to jump to another
tree. Did too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But, yes. I see that mislabeled as a sclerotium on the fungus. Mm-hmm. Not a sclerotium?
No, it's a gall. It's an insect gall. Yeah. So this is another thing. I mean, there's all sorts of other things that have been called galls, sclerotia, chaga, you know, called a sclerotia or whatever. I mean, this. The more you look into stuff, it turns out, oh, it doesn't really do what we thought it did. So David showed some photos of things that were eating mushrooms and causing decay and stuff, so I figured I'd better toss a few in. You know, we're not the only organisms that like eating mushrooms. There's all kinds of animals. And so usually when you come upon a mushroom that's been eaten by a slug, it's been kind of rasped away. But there's some slugs that are so big and some mushrooms that are so small, sometimes these slugs can just eat the entire thing, all in one fall. And These are, most of the photos here are my own, but the slug photos are from a lady who's super into slugs and mushrooms. She's out in the Midwest. And she hunts down and has zillions of slug on mushroom.
Has she eaten the slugs?
I think she may have. It would be something she would do. I don't really eat slugs too much, although, I've eaten snails and I guess they taste like slugs. Yeah. I don't know if they taste like the mushrooms that eat, but there's, of course, all kinds of other animals that eat mushrooms besides us, slugs, etc. And in fact, there's so many that that's actually what's been the subject of my research for over 30 years. I study insects that have co-evolved with mushrooms. And it's extremely lonely field because there's like five of us in the world. Really, no one cares. But when you see the maggots that are saying mushrooms, that's usually when I get excited, right? I'm at four at the end, I'm just waiting, and everyone's done talking. And I start taking the stuff off the table, and where's he going with those? Yeah. So anyways, this is the type of stuff that gets me excited. This is King Bully, exciting. This is a King Bully with bugs in it, also exciting for me because I like to see what's eating things. It turns out the mushrooms actually welcome bugs to them because it seems the insects, the slugs, other things are the disseminators of the spores of the fungus, believe it or not. So they're usually not trying to fight them off. I mean, they could if they wanted to, but they don't really seem to. They seem to be partners, and we don't really know a whole lot about it. Mushrooms, a lot of people liken to like fruits on an apple tree or something, but it's really more like flowers. A mushroom functions sort of as a flower. They make one in spores, which are basically like pollen, and those have to then get together with another one in a component propagule of the plant or fungus, whichever you want to consider it, and recombine to restore the different state, which Paul was talking about at the table earlier. So I'm usually pretty excited to see all kinds of different mushroom flies. This is just a couple pictures, and then I'll be back to the other stuff. Mushroom flies come in sort of two different flavors, sort of the very lower flies. And again, when you approach these beautiful mushrooms, they would have gone away and you would have never known that this mushroom had all kinds of stuff going on. But if you just wait a while, things like these lower mushroom flies, these fungus gnats would come back, they look kind of like mosquitoes, and higher flies that look kind of like what you would call fruit flies, they'd come back. And these are the dominant life forms eating mushrooms on the planet, especially these drosophila types. There's lots of species, all they eat are mushrooms. They probably evolved into mushroom eaters because all drosophila flies come from yeast feeders on wounds and trees and stuff like that, and then they radiated out over all the plants eat fruit and all kinds of other things, and they're maybe one of the most successful groups of animals on the planet. There's thousands of species of drosophila type flies. You've seen just Drosophila melanogaster and maybe one other species in your home. That's not the habit. They can eat anything from petroleum seeping from the ground to are living in apple cider to just about any carbon source on the planet. So they're pretty amazing, and a bunch of them are evolved to eat nothing but mushrooms. And how they do it is this structure here. I had to put this slide in because I had seen ahead of time that David was going to malign the maggots and show this disgusting, gushy thing. It makes it seem like they're kind of lowly, but they're actually highly specialized. In fact, they're more adapted to do what they do than, of course, you are. I mean, you couldn't live in a rotting mushroom that's cushy, you would drown. So they have these rasping mouth parts in the front. The breathing apparatus is like a snorkel in the back so they don't drown. And they've got their legs and things that would get in the way of trying to crawl through their food source. They just have all of these bristles. So the next time you see maggots in your trash can or whatever, they look kind of disturbing. If you looked at them really closely with your hand lens, like you do with a mushroom, you say, wow, these things actually have a lot of specialization. They've gotten rid of legs and stuff like that for a reason. And they look so gruesome because that's how to do that job better. So anyways, and then there's all sorts of other things that are on the mushroom looking for these as prey. So if you look really closely on the other side of mushrooms, you'll see often these super tiny flies, except they're not flies, they're parasitic wasps. And they're looking for all the different maggots that they can hear crawling around inside of the mushroom. No doubt if you've picked oyster mushrooms, you've seen these so-called pleasing fungus beetles. They're not really very pleasing because they red tar mushrooms, but sometimes they're quite pretty, like the blue one. This is super common in the East. If you've been oyster mushrooms, you've seen this. Yeah, so several people know. They know. And then David even showed a picture of a slime mold oozing over the surface of the oyster mushroom. That's not what the arrows are pointing to. The arrows are pointing to some cute little mushroom flies that are also living in. So you can see there's a whole community of stuff going on here. Several different kingdoms of organisms just on these oyster mushrooms that you're about to put in your mouth. And if you're a beginner to mushroom and you are squeamish about putting bugs in your mouth, just actually leave right now, because this is really going to gross you out. If you eat wild mushrooms, you eat a lot of bugs. That's not a big deal. But you also eat a lot of nematodes and stuff that's even grosser. So on all fruiting bodies, and there's only a couple types that don't get mushroom bugs eating them, on all the fruiting bodies, they get slugs, mushroom-feeding beetles, mushroom-feeding flies, nematodes, and stuff. They all arrive, they start having sex, there's like a sex party rolling all about on this mushroom before you come along and frighten them away. And so they've just had this big sex party on this like couch on a stem, and you don't see it, but so these guys are doing their stuff and they're eating, and then they leave behind all of the eggs, and so then that's when stuff really gets crazy. So all of the different maggots and larvae are inside the mushrooms. You've eaten them if you eat wild mushrooms, and other things come to take the maggots away. So we saw just the other day, we picked a dried saddle or pheasant's back, and it's on the window sill over there. We looked real closely, and sure enough, I could see all this grass hanging down. So I knew that there was a lot of bug activity, and just hold it and look at it a bit. And sure enough, out of the holes start coming these little tiny beetles, these Lordothion beetles. And they're not eating the mushroom, they're looking for maggots. Here one has a little baby maggot here. It's kind of a sad scene. And they haul them up, and that's all they do. They go from mushroom to mushroom looking for prey. And there's the parasitic wasps. And here's a parasitic wasp here, injecting an egg into a puparia of a fly before it's even going to turn into a fly. Here's all the nematodes. If you've ever looked at mushrooms closely under hand lens, you might see kind of a glistening. You usually have to get maybe a dissecting scope. But every mushroom, I mean, all the mushrooms that you eat, before you eat them, this is really fun, before you fry them up, put them under a dissecting scope. You'll see the surface glistening, because there's zillions of nematodes. What are these nematodes doing? Why are they eating the mushrooms? They're not eating the mushrooms. All of these organisms see a mushroom, and they know this is where the bug sex party is going to happen. These big dummies are going to come landing, and I'm going to eat them or parasitize them. So mushrooms get covered with these nematodes, super tiny ones. They're so tiny, they can live inside the gonads of those little mushroom flies. That's how tiny they are. In fact, that's in some of the species, that's all they feed on, are the fly gonads. And I don't know why, but that's just what they do. So in fact, some of these have been marketed. So if you're in the mushroom business and you grow like over by Kennett Square where they have big mushroom houses, you can buy these things that are sprays of parasitic wasps like this guy, or sprays of nematodes like this, and you spray them on your bed, and all of those pests, the nematodes and everything, keep your mushroom house bug free. And yeah, those nematodes then are in the agaricus in the grocery store writhing around. So you're eating them. Even if you're not eating wild mushrooms, you're eating all of this stuff, believe it or not. But it's really cool because it's totally safe. It's not like that. That's the same. So, and then now we come back to the oysters. So oyster mushrooms have something else going on, which is probably why they're so enticing to all of these bugs. Oyster mushrooms can capture the nematodes and use them as a protein source. And there's other mushrooms that can do this as well. They have sticky traps and things. And you know, they go through this trouble because there's so many nematodes that normally are on these mushrooms. They actually have special structures evolved just to snare nematodes and eat them and use them as a protein source. So it's my belief, there's not really anyone that's been looking at this, but one of the reasons why oyster mushrooms get so many beetles and flies coming to them is because they know by the smell or the look, this is one of these couches that doesn't have all of these things, so I can have a really nice sex party there, not be interrupted by all the nematodes crawling up my legs and trying to get into my gonads. This is what they do. I didn't invent it. You can look it up. So this is the mushroom that had the little beetles in it over there. So This question, if you were out in the springtime, long, long time ago, you would see this in morel season, right? Everybody knows. Now we're getting to have more and more often, we're seeing this in the fall. So they're starting to have sort of two seasons, and it's probably because of climate change. Flowers around the world are having two seasons, are blooming earlier, and mushrooms are coming up earlier too. So this is obviously a polypore, and it's a wood rotter. It's not mycorrhizal, it's definitely a rotter. It's rotting away on the stump. Some other polypores that are familiar to you are things like the sulfur shell from the chicken of the woods, real pretty mushroom. If you've never eaten wild mushrooms and you see something that's bright orange on one side and bright yellow on the other, your evolution tells you that's probably dangerous because those look like warning colors to me. But that's not the way the fungal world works. The dangerous mushrooms are usually drab colors like brown or white. There's really no dangerous garishly colored mushrooms that are red and yellow, like this guy here. And if you're a kid, you know about polypores because you maybe leave messages to your dad in the woods on the underside of polypores or to your friends. That's an artist's conch being used as sort of a signpost by my daughter, which she used to think that was pretty cool before she got older and that mushrooms aren't cool. So we look more closely at these polypores. Paul mentioned this mushroom, and no one even caught it. No one heard this mention. This Phalcalicium. What's the name? Phalcalicium. So this is on the surface of real boring trichaptum polypore. We brought in several today. It's the violet tooth polypore. Nothing especially remarkable about it, except they'll persist on trees well after the season's over with, and you'll find them the next year, and they've changed colors and stuff. If you look at these things super closely, you'll see these little matchsticks that he mentioned. Super tiny little fungus sticking up. This is how small they are. That's my thumb. So you gotta look really closely. What are they doing? There's lots of other fungi that grow on fungi. Doesn't seem to be a parasite. It seems to be growing on, I don't know what, maybe the algae on the surface or something else. Who knows what it's really doing here. Maybe it's an endophyte inside of the polypore and is a partner. Literally no one knows, but we do know that if we look closely at other polypores and other mushrooms, the polypores especially, because they're perennial, so they'll stay on the tree a long time. You know, agarics, they're going to come up and go away, so they're not going to have stuff hanging around all season like these. This is what they look
That's
like.
Great.
Isn't that wild? So, but there's other things too. There's other fungi that live on polypores. Look underneath and you might see stuff like this. You can see the pores of this Ganoderma down here. These are the pores, so it's the hymenal surface. And this is an interesting fungus that creeps along underneath the fungus. And some of these species of Sporophyomyces, some of them seem to be kind of rotters of old conchs. But what they do when the conch is alive and vibrant is they sit right underneath the polypore and catch the spores raining down, and that's all they feed on. So they're sort of pirating the spores. You can see all the white spores on this sort of thing. This is what it would most likely look like if you ripped the entire conch off. So this thing was living under there while this thing was healthy and vibrant and releasing spores and catching the spores and feeding off them. And then once the polypore is shot for the season, then it seems to maybe rot the tissues. But again, I think a lot of people really don't know what Sporophyomyces does. The name, Sporophyomyces. So it's a fungus, it's a mycetes, and phago means to eat, and sporo is spores. So it's the fungus that eats spores of other fungi. So that's the poetry of the mushroom fungi. There's all kinds of other fungi that live on fungi. There's Asteropteras that live on rotting, rushulas and things. There's a number of different Calibias that fruit on nothing but old and rotting and decayed mushrooms from earlier in the season. This is David Work's photo. This is one of the few photos that really aren't mine. David Work is in the Mid-Hudson Club and takes astoundingly beautiful photos. So this picture here, again, a lot going on in this photo. So I'll have to need a program and I have to walk you through it. So this is the extremely boring Calibia or Gymnopus dryophila. There's a bunch of them on the table there. I would never have picked them up except I wanted to point it out to everyone. So this thing occurs all over the forest. It rots anything cellulosic. So it's on, looks like wood here. This looks like burned wood. This isn't burned wood. This is no doubt Ustoida deusta, which looks like a burn on top of wood. It's super common. You've all seen it. You just thought it was burned wood, but it's not. And so on top of the Calibia is this other fungus that's a parasite, and it fruits nowhere else but on top of this Calibia. And it's Caesicus aura, or Christiansenia. That's the one place it fruits. It looks kind of like a tremella, so someone called it a tremella a long time ago. And Mycetophyllus, so it's a lover of mushrooms. So it's the mushroom lover. And here's some other mushroom lovers here, too. So here's Drosophilid fly trying to get at the fungus. And here's a parasitic wasp. You can see it's about a tenth the size. It's looking for babies of something like this. So a lot of stuff going on just on the mushroom besides this boring Calibia that, again, I never would have picked a lot of other kind of things. So going back to the polypores, have you ever seen this beetle before? Super common beetle. When you've seen it, it's probably been in the middle of winter in your house, because if you have kids, they'll rip polypores off of trees, bring them inside, forget about them under the bed, in your drawer, and then all of a sudden in your house in the middle of winter, this beetle, well, not this one, thousands of ones like this are all over your house, and they stink very bad, and they're kind of cool to see. But that's because, I was an entomologist before I actually got into mushrooms. So they're cool to see, but wow, are they stinky? What's that? It's not, it's not a stink bug, it's a beetle. A stink bug is a true bug. So if you're an entomologist, a stink bug is a true bug, and true bugs suck. They have sucking mouth parts. Beetles chew, so this is definitely not a true bug. So anyways, these guys emerge from polypores, and they're pretty cool to see. But look even closer at the polypore. That same beetle dwarfs some other beetles that are also on the polypore. Look, this is as big as this guy gets. This guy eats the polypore, tunnels through it as larvae comes out, and it's like the size of one of your fingernails or one of your small fingernails. This thing is super tiny. So what does it feed on? It feeds. Look how tiny. That's the thing they get. It feeds only on spores. So it has to be tiny, because it has to be small enough to get inside the pores of polypores and eat. And what's more amazing is, that's not the only thing that does this. Lots of things do this. The only thing they feed on are spores of certain polypores. They go in and out of the tubes. These are columbolids here. These an interesting group of springtail type insects. There's springtails that eat other plant debris, woody debris, all kinds of other things. These are springtails that feed, it seems, only on mushroom spores. Has anyone heard of springtails? When you pick morels in the spring, the springtails are popping off of them. So everyone's heard of them. Almost nobody knows anything about them. What we do know about them, but really the one factor we do know is, we know they're the most important animals in the forest, in temperate forest, the most important animals to cycle carbon. And we literally know nothing about them. But we know the forest is literally controlled by them as to cycle carbon from plant material back into the environment. So the tiniest things sometimes have the biggest impacts. Let's look even closer at that same bolt, at that same, I believe, Thuris beetle, that great big beetle, which really isn't that big. If you look really closely at him, so this is on the mushroom surface of the forest, what we'll see is, there's hitchhikers on this beetle. What are they doing? Are they parasites? No. These are things called phoretic mites. Phoretic mites are everywhere in the planet. Oh my gosh, you have them all over you right now. They eat all, phoresis just means like hitchhiking. So these mites eat all sorts of things, but how they get around is they've given up flying. That's not how they get around. They figured out how to hitchhike on other bugs, birds, all sorts of things. So if it's a mushroom feeder, they know where to go. A mushroom, when they're done feeding, they just kind of wait there. Here comes one of those insects along to have the sex party that I mentioned. And then they take off, and then they get transported to the next mushroom, and they just pop off. So if you look closely at all kinds of different beetles, you might see things that look like just part of their structure, or things that maybe are brightly colored on the surface. But if you look closely, they're actually other bugs.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it's not just mites, there's other arthropods that hitchhike too. Did you ever wonder how these really cute pseudoscorpions get around? That's how they get around too. These things are so small. I mean, if they wanted to go to a different part of the forest because it's drying out or whatever, they can't fly, but they know how to travel pretty long distances, so they grab onto other bugs and take off. So that's a pseudoscorpion there too. So interesting. So all sorts of beetles have these. These are ambrosia beetles, and ambrosia beetles, once they land on their food source, they burrow into the food source, which is trees. And you probably thought, oh, they're eating the wood, they're a wood boring beetle, and everyone's seen dead trees lying around in the forest, and the bark, once it's knocked off, you can see these galleries and tunnels, right? You've seen them. You may not have known what you're looking at, because beetles do two different things. For sure, what they don't do is they for sure don't eat and digest wood. Animals don't do that. They have to have microbes to break down. Think of cows. They appear to be eating and living off of grass and hay. They're not. The microbes in their stomachs are fermenting and breaking down the cellulose, and that allows the cow to survive. So whales the same way. Whales that are grazing, the same way. All of these grazing animals that use microbes, they're not big because they can get big on their nutrient-rich diet. Actually, their diet is extremely poor. They're not big because they can be. They're big because they have to be. They have to have these gigantic stomachs to ferment this nutrient-poor cellulose and live off of it. So all things that are grazers, especially that stuff that's really nutrient-poor cellulose, like grass and algae and stuff like that in the ocean, they have to be big, or they have to figure some other way to break this stuff down. These guys have figured another way. They don't have to have super giant stomachs, because that would be ridiculous. They're a beetle. So rather than have a big tummy with all this stuff in their microbes, they bring the microbes and unleash it in their food source and let it degrade. So these beetles burrow into wood. They're not eating the wood at all. They're just making tunnels. And then they inoculate the wood of the tree with a fungus and then live the rest of their lives eating nothing but the fungus. And that's what their babies eat. These are ambrosia beetles. So these are what have done in the part of the reason of what's done in the American elm trees and all the great big ones have gone away. The trees still make seeds, so you still have more coming back, which is, I guess, kind of a good thing. You have elms coming up and living and then dying, and that pops up somewhere else. So you can see in these galleries, these aren't really tunnels, these are galleries, so they climb through here and inoculate it with their fungus. So how do they inoculate these things with their fungus? Oh, here's a slide to point out two different types of these tunnels. So you've most likely seen things like this on dead trees. These are various types of bark beetles. And what happens here is the mama of a bark beetle, not an ambrosia beetle, but a bark beetle, mama lights on the outside of the tree where there's bark here. She eats her way through here. She has some microbes in her stomach, but they're not really efficient at eating cellulose, but they can get by with eating it. She eats her way through the phloem here, lays eggs as she goes, and makes another tunnel here and comes out the bark. So there's this tunnel of eggs in it. Each egg hatches, and then a baby grub eats its way through the tree, radiating out away from the center. And that's why it looks like this kind of centipede in the tree here. Again, they're not really that good at eating wood, so they could really live only in the phloem just under that bark. They couldn't live anywhere else in the wood. Ambrosia beetles can, because they have microbes that they bring to the tree, and then they make these galleries. You can even see the mold growing in here. And then the mold, of course, can kill the tree, and that's what did an elm tree stress. This only was carried by these guys, and they inoculated the tree. So how do they inoculate the tree? Is this haphazard? They just take a mouthful? No, they've been at it a really long time, and they actually have structures that have evolved on their surface to do nothing but carry the fungus. And so on ambrosia beetles, on the back of the mom is this pouch called a mycangium. It serves no other purpose than to scrape fungus off of the burrow which she leaves, and then as she digs through the burrow, you can see she's really big and scrapes the surface and inoculates all along here. This is the male, they're a lot smaller, and they don't carry the fungus. So in fact, you know, he doesn't make contact with the wood, so he wouldn't really even be able to inoculate.
And where is she picking up the fungus?
Yeah.
She has the fungus, so she picked it up as a baby coming out of the gallery that her mom made when she leaves.
Yeah.
So she keeps picking it from tree to tree. So everyone's heard about the different types of termites that cultivate mushrooms and other fungi. That's cool. But there's all kinds of other insects that do the same thing that you've probably never heard of. But you've probably seen them, you just didn't know what they were doing. This was a paper that just came out last year that even talked about some of the special coevolution between beetles and the fungus. So anyways, so the quote was, animals can't digest cellulose, and even that's really not true. Believe it or not, humans can even break down cellulose somewhat. We have fermenting gut bacteria in our intestines that can partially break down woody plant material, and also even chitinous material from mushrooms. But we don't live on the chitinous cell walls of mushrooms. We don't live on the cellulose of the plant, so we don't really have to get a lot of nutrition from that and other things. But anyways, it's been found that some of these insects have co-evolved with their symbiotic partners, their microbes, for so long they've actually either picked up genes from the microbes and now have them in their genome to make these enzymes, or they've just evolved them from scratch. So again, humans can, to some extent, digest cellulose, believe it or not. One group in particular, the original native Japanese on some of the Japanese islands, they can eat seaweed and digest that and pretty much live off of it. Whereas when we eat seaweed on sushi and stuff like that, you know, most of that fiber passes out of us. But their diet has been integral with the seaweed for so long, they can actually break down a lot of the cellulose. So in any case, that's, I'm at 45 minutes, so that's the end of my talk. So thanks for your time.